356.
C3. Oxymorphone hydrochloride.
357.
Admittedly, yes, C2. But more than indicated in this degree of needless suffering.
Gailey can hear ferocious Francis blowing his nose again, behind the MD. Gailey's mouth floods with spittle at the memory of the sick, sweet, antiseptic taste of hydrochloride that rises to the tongue with an injection of Demerol. The taste, Kite, and the lesbian burglars, and even Equus.
I'll stick anything in any part of my body,
Reese, all gagged at. But that poor old Nooch, and Gene Fackelman, and Gately himself had loved. Came to love like a mother's warm hand. Gately's eyes wobble and his tongue protrudes from a shiny mouth corner, as he draws a crude syringe in arm and belt, and then tries to draw skull and bones over the whole shaky ensemble. But the skull looks more like a plain old smiley face. He holds it out to the foreigner anyway. The dextral pain's so bad he wants to throw up, throat tube or no. The MD studies the palsied drawing, nodding the exact way Gately used to nod at Alfonso Porrias Carbo, the totally un-understandable Cuban.
Oxycodone naloxone compound with a short half-life.
358.
But only a C3 grading of abuse.
There's no way the guy could be, like, intentionally making his voice this wheedly sounding. It's got to be Gately's own disease. The spider. Gately envisions his brain struggling in a silk cocoon. He keeps summoning to mind the little detox story ferocious Francis tells from the commitment podium, how they gave him Librium to help with the discomfort of withdrawal.
359.
And now Francis says he just threw the Librium hard over his left shoulder, for luck, and has had very good luck ever since.
Likewise as well, the time-tested pentazocine lactate, which I can offer with assurances, as a Muslim trauma professional standing here in this room in person with you at your bed's side.
Pentazocine lactate is Tolwyn, Gately's number two trusted standard when he was out there, which 120 milligrams on an empty gut was like floating in oil, the exact same temperature as your body, just like Percocet.
360.
Except without the maddening back-of-the-eyeball itch that always wrecked a Percocet high for him.
Surrender your courageous fear of dependence and let us do our profession, young sir,
the Pakistani sums up, standing right up next to the bed, the left side, his professional lab coat hiding FF, hands behind his back, the dull glint of the metal corner of Gately's chart just visible between his legs, immaculate of posture, smiling cheerily down, the whites of his eyes as ungodly white as his teeth. The memory of Tolwyn makes parts of his body, Gately didn't know could drool, drool. He knows what's coming next, Gately does. And if the Pakistani goes ahead and offers Demerol again, Gately won't resist. And who the fuck will be able to blame him, after all? Why should he have to resist? He'd received a bona fide grade whatever dextral synovial trauma. Shot with a professionally modified 44 item. He's post-trauma, in terrible pain, and everyone heard the guy say it. It was going to get worse, the pain. This was a trauma pro in a white coat here, making reassurances of legitimate fucking use. Gahaney heard him. What the fuck did the flaggers want from him? This wasn't hardly like slipping over to Unit Number 7 with a syringe and a bottle of Visine. This was a stop-term measure. A short-gap-type measure. The probable intervention of a compassionate, unjudging God. A quick prescription squirt of Demerol. Probably at the outside. 2-3 days of a Demerol drip, maybe even one where they'd hook the drip to a rubber bulb he could hold and self-administer the Demerol only as needed. Maybe it was the disease itself telling him to be scared. A medically necessary squirt would pull all his old triggers again, put him back in the cage. Gately pictures himself trying to shunt through a magnetic contact burglar alarm with a hand and a hook. But surely if ferocious Francis thought a medically advised short-term squirt suspect at all, the old reptilian bastard would say something, do his fucking job as a crocodile and sponsor, instead of just sitting there playing with his nostrils' little non-invasive tube.
Look, kid, I'm gonna screw and let you settle this bullshit and come back up later.
comes Francis's voice, subdued and neutral, signifying nothing. And then, the rasp of the chair's legs, and the system of grunts that always accompanies FF's getting up from a chair. His white crew cut rises like a slow moon over the Pakistani shoulder, which the MD's only sign of acknowledgement of Francis is to sort of tuck his chin down into his shoulder like a violinist, addressing Gately's sponsor for the first time.
"Then perhaps you would please, Mr. Gately, Senior, if you please help us. Help your concerned and brave boy here, but a boy I believe whose cavalier attitude underestimates the level of coming discomfort, which is sadly unnecessary, altogether, if he will let us help him, sir."
The Pakistani sings over his shoulder to Ferocious Francis, as if they were the room's only adults. He's assuming Ferocious Francis is Gately's organic dad. Gately knows a crocodile never bothers to correct anybody's misimpression. He's halfway to the door, moving with maddening slow care like always, as if walking on ice, twisted and seeming to limp off both legs, and heartbreakingly assless in the baggy, seat-shiny, wide-wailed old man's corduroys he always wears, the back of his red neck complexly creased as he moves off away, lifting one hand in a gesture of acknowledgement and dismissal of the MD's request.
"Not my business to say one way or the other. Kid's gonna do what he decides he needs to do for himself. He's the one that's feeling it. He's the only one can decide."
He either pauses or slows down even further at the open door, looking back at Gately, but not meeting his wide eyes.
"You keep your pecker up, kid, and I'll bring some of the son-of-a-bitches by to look in again later."
He slips in.
"Might want to ask for some help deciding."
The last of this comes from the white hall, as the Pakistani's glossy head comes back in close, with now a tight, strained patient smile, and Gately can hear him inhaling to get ready to say that, of course, in grade two traumas of this severe type, the treatment of preferred indication is the admittedly C2 and highly abusable but unsurpassed for effectiveness and tightly controlled administration of 150 milligram tab in a diluting saline drip quarterly, 3 to 4 hours of MEP. Gately's good left hand skins a knuckle, shooting out between the bars of the bedside crib railing and plunging under the MD's lab coat and fastening onto the guy's balls and bearing down. The Pakistani pharmacologist screams like a woman. It isn't rage or the will to harm, so much as just no other ideas for keeping the bastard from offering something Gately knows that he's powerless at this moment to refuse. The sudden exertion sends a blue-green sheet of pain over Gately that makes his eyes roll up as he bears down on the balls, but not enough to crush. The Pakistani curtsies deeply and bends forward, crumpling around Gately's hand, showing all 112 teeth as he screams higher and higher until he hits a jagged high note, like a big opera lady in a Viking helmet, so shattering it makes the crib railings and window glass shiver. And woke Don Gately up with a start, his left arm through the railing and twisted with the force of his attempt to sit up, so that the pain now made him hit almost the same high note as the dream's foreign MD. The sky outside the window was gorgeous, dilaudid colored. The room was full of serious AM light, no sleet on the window. The ceiling throbbed a little but did not breathe. The one visitor chair was back over by the wall. He looked down. Either the stenographer's notebook and pen had got knocked off his bed, or the dream had made up that part, too. The next bed was still empty and made up tight. It came to him all of a sudden why they called them hospital corners. But the railing Joel Van D had folded down to sit on the bunk, in the fucking Erdetti kid sweats, was still folded down, and the other railing was still up. So there was some, like, evidence of the one part, that she'd been really there, showing him the pictures. Gately brought his skinned hand gingerly back inside the railing, and felt to make sure there really was a big invasive tube going into his mouth, and there was. He could roll his eyes way up and see his heart monitor going silently nuts. Sweat was coming off every part of him, and for the first time in the trauma wing, he felt like he needed to take a shit. and he had no idea what arrangements there were for taking a shit, but suspected they weren't going to be appetizing at all. Second, second, he tried to abide. No single second was past enduring. The intercom was giving triple dings. There really were sounds of other rooms' TPs, and of a meal cart being rolled down the hall, and the metally smell of food for the edible patients. He couldn't see anything like a hat shadow in the hall, but it could have been all the sunlight. The dream's vividness had been either fever or disease, but either way, it had fucking seriously rattled his cage. He heard the sing-song voice promising about increasing discomfort. His shoulder beat like a big heart, and the pain was sickeninger than ever. No single second was past standing. Memories of good old Demerol rose up, clamoring to be entertained. The thing in Boston AA is they try to teach you to accept occasional cravings, the sudden thoughts of the substance. They tell you that sudden substance cravings will rise unbidden in a true addict's mind like bubbles in a toddler's bath. It's a lifelong disease. You can't keep the thoughts from popping in there. The thing they try to teach you is just to let them go. The thoughts. Let them come as they will, but do not entertain them. No need to invite a substance, thought, or memory in. Offer it a tonic in your favorite chair, and chat with it about old times. The thing about Demerol wasn't just the womb-warm buzz of a serious narcotic. It was more like the, what? The aesthetics of the buzz. Gately'd always found Demerol, with a slight Tolwyn kicker, such a smooth and orderly buzz. A somehow deliciously symmetrical buzz. The mind floats, easy in the exact center of a brain, but floats cushioned in a warm skull that itself sits perfectly centered on a cushion of soft air, some neckless distance above the shoulders. And inside all is a somnolent hum. Chest rises and falls on its own, far away. The easy squeak of your head's blood is like bed springs in the friendly distance. The sun itself seems to be smiling. And when you nod off, you sleep like a man of wax, and awaken in the same last position you remember falling asleep in. And pain of all sorts becomes a theory, a news item in the distant colder climes, way below the warm air you hum on. And what you feel is mostly gratitude at your abstract distance from anything that doesn't sit inside concentric circles, and love what's happening. Gailey takes advantage of the fact that he's already facing ceilingward to seriously ask for help with the obsession. He thinks hard about anything else at all. Heading out with old Gary Carty in the pre-dawn reek of low tide off Beverly to bring up lobster traps. The MP and the flies. His mother sleeping slack-mouthed on a chintz divan. Cleaning the very grossest corner of the Shattuck shelter. The billow of the veiled girl's veil. The trap's little cages of cross-hatched bars. The lobster's eyes stalks, always poking through the squares so the eyes looked out at open sea. Or the bumper stickers on the MP's old Ford. See ya! And, don't tailgate me or I'll flick a booger on your windshield. And, MIA, forgotten. And, I haven't had sex in so long I forget who gets tied up. The fish asking about what's water. The sharp-nosed, round-cheeked, dead-eyed nurse with a weird Germanish accent that would sell Gately little sampler bottles of Sanofi Winthrop Demerol syrup, 80 milligrams a bottle, vilely banana-flavored, then would lie back, slack and dead-eyed, while Gately X'd her, barely breathing, in an airless Ipswich apartment whose weird brown window shades filled the place with light the color of weak tea. Named Egeda, or Egety. She eventually started telling Gately she couldn't come close to coming unless he burned her with a cigarette, which marked the first time Gately seriously tried to quit smoking. Now a black outside linebacker of a St. E's nurse rumbles in and checks his drips and writes on his chart and points the artillery of her tits down at him to ask how he's doing, and calls him baby, which nobody minds from enormous black nurses. Gately points at his lower abdomen in the area of his colon and tries to make a broad, explosive gesture with just one arm, slightly less mortified than if it had been a human-sized white nurse, at least. Gately happened onto Demerol at age 23, when intraocular itching finally forced him to abandon Percocets and explore new vistas. Demerol was more expensive, milligram for milligram, than most synthetic narcs, but it was also easier to get, being the treatment of medical choice for mind-bending post-operative pain. Gately can't for the life of him remember who or just where in Salem he was first introduced to what the boys on the North Shore called Pebbles and Bam Bam. 50 and 100 milligram Demerol tablets, respectively very tiny and tiny, chalky white scored discs with D/35 on one side, and Sanofi Winthrop Company's very soon-beloved trademark, a kind of W on the other, that rakish W just puncturing the square envelope of itchy-eyed North Shore life. And remembering even the D/35 feels like entertaining the obsession. He knows it was not long after Nooch's funeral, because he'd been alone and crewless at whatever moment whoever handed him 2 50-milligram tablets, way too tiny for his big-fingered hands, in lieu of whatever else it was he'd wanted, laughing when Gately said, "What the fuck?" and, "They look like bufferin for ants," or some shit, saying, "Trust me." It must have been his 23rd summer out there, because he remembers being shirtless and driving down 93 when he ran out of everything else and pulled off into the JFK library lot to take them. So small and tasteless, he had to check his open mouth in the rear view to make sure he'd gotten them down. And he remembers not wearing a shirt because he'd gotten to study his big, bare, hairless chest for a long time. And from that somnolent PM in the JFK lot on, he'd been a faithful attendant at the goddess Demerol's temple, right to the very finish. Gately remembers crewing for good bits of both the Percocet and Demerol eras with two other North Shore narcotics addicts, who Gately'd grown up with one, and had broke digits for Whitey Sorkin, the migrainous bookie, with the other. They weren't burglars, either of them, these guys. Fackelman and Kite. Fackelman had a background in creative-type checks, plus access to equipment for manufacturing ID. And Kite's background was he'd been a computer weenie at Salem State before he got the shoe for hacking the phone bills of certain guys deep in trouble over 900 sex lines into the SS administration's Watts account. And they became naturals at crewing together, F and K, and had their own unambitious but elegant scam going that Gately was ever only marginally in on. What Fackelman and Kite'd do, they'd rig up an identity and credit record sufficient to rent them a luxury-furnished apartment. Then they'd rent a lot of upscale-type appliances from, like, Rent-A-Center or Rent-To-Own down in Boston. Then they'd sell the luxury appliances and furnishings off to one of a couple dependable fences. Then they'd bring in their own air mattresses and sleeping bags and canvas chairs and little legit-bought TP and viewer and speakers and camp out in the empty luxury apartment, getting very high on the rented goods net proceeds until they got their second overdue notice on the rent. Then they'd rig up another identity and move on and do it all over. Gately took his turn being the one to bathe and shave and answer a luxury apartment rental ad in borrowed yuppie wear and meet the property management people and sweep them off their band fees with his ID and credit rating and forge some name on the lease. And he usually crashed and got high in the apartments with Fackelman and Kite, though he, Gately, and had his own digit-breaking and then later burglary career, and his own fences, and tended more and more to cop his own scripts and his own Percocets, and then later Demerol. Lying there, working on abiding and not entertaining, Gately remembers how good old doomed Gene Fackelman, that foreign narcotics addict had had a truly raging libido, used to like to bring different girls home to whatever apartment they were scamming at the time, And Halifax would open the door and look around and pretend astonishment at the empty and carpetless luxury apartment and shout, "We've been fucking robbed!" For Fackelman and Kite, the rap on Gately was that he was a great and, for a narcotics addict which places limits on rational trusting, stand-up guy. And a ferociously good friend and crewmate. But they just didn't for their lives see why Gately chose to be a narcotics man. Why these were his substances of choice. Because he was a great and cheerful, stand-up, jolly-type guy off the nod, but when he was pebbled or narculated in any way, he'd become this totally taciturn, withdrawn, dead-like person, they always said, like a totally different Gately, sitting for hours real low in his canvas chair, practically lying in this chair whose canvas bulged and legs bowed out, speaking barely at all, and then only the necessariest word or two, and then, without ever seeming to open his mouth, he made whoever he got high with feel lonely. He got real, like, interior. Pamela Hoffman Jeep's term was other-directed, and it was worse when he shot anything up. You'd have to almost pry his chin off his chest. Kite used to say it was like Gately shot cement instead of narcotics. McDade and Dial come in around 1100 hours from visiting Dooney Glynn down somewheres in the gastroenterology department and try to give Gately's left hand archaic, old, unhip high fives as a goof and say the bowel guys have got Glynn on a mega drip of a Levsin codeine diverticulitis compound.
361.
And Dune seemed to have undergone a kind of spiritual experience vis-a-vis this compound and was giving them ebullient high fives. And saying the bowel MDs were saying that there was a chance the condition might be inoperable and chronic, and that DG'd have to be on the compound for life, with a rubber bulb for self-administration, and the formerly fetal Dune was sitting up in a lotus position and seemed to be a very happy camper indeed. Gately makes pathetic sounds around his oral tube as McDade and Dial start to interrupt each other, apologizing for how it's looking like they might not be able to stand up and legally depose for Gately, like they'd be ready to do in a fucking hatbeat, if it weren't for various legal issues they're still under the clouds of that their PD and PO, respectively, say that walking voluntarily into Norfolk District Court in Enfield would be titamount to, like, judicio-penal suicide, they're told. Dial looks at McDade and then says there's also disparaging news about the 44 item, that by everybody's reconstruction of events, it's more than likely Lentz might have promoted the item up off the lawn when he legged it off the EMPHH complex just ahead of the finest. Because it's fucking vanished, and nobody'd have rat-holed it and not given it up, knowing what's at stake for the good old G-man in the deal. Gately makes a whole new kind of noise. McDade says the more upbeat news is that Lentz has been possibly spotted, that Ken E. and Bert F. Smith had seen what looked like, either R. Lentz or C. Romero, after a wasting illness, on their way back from wheeling Bert F. S. to a meeting in Kenmore Square, mostly from the side of the back they'd seen him, wearing a back-split tux and sombrero with balls, and apparently officially relapsed back out there, drunk as a maroon, so totally legless when they saw him, he was doing a drunk's old hurricane walk, fighting his way from parking meter to parking meter, and clinging to each parking meter. Wade McDade here thinks to insert that the confirmed scuttlebutt is that EMPHH is getting ready to rent out Unit Number 3 to a long-term mental health agency, caring for people with incapacitating agoraphobia, and that everybody at the house is speculating on what a constantly crowded and cabin feverish place that's going to be, what with the terribleness of the predicted winter coming up. Dial says his nasal sinus can always tell when it's going to snow, and his sinus is starting to predict at least flurries for maybe as early as tonight. They never think to tell Gately what day it is. That Gately can't communicate even this most basic of requests makes him want to scream. McDade, in what's either an intimate aside or a knife twist to a staffer who's in no position to enforce anything, confides that he and Emil Minty are arranging with Parias Carbo, who works for an Ennethouse alum at Albright Printing, down near the Jackson Mann School, for engraved-looking formal invitations for the agoraphobic folks in Unit Number 3 to all just come on out and over to Ennett House for a crowded, noisy outdoor Welcome to the EMPHH Neighborhood Bash. And now Gately knows for sure it was McDade and Minty that put the Help Wanted sign up under the window of the lady in Unit Number 4 that shouts for help. The general level of tension in the room increases. Gavin Dial clears his throat and says, "Everybody says to say Gately's like wicked mist back at the house, and everybody said to say, sup, and that they hope the G-Man's up and back kicking residential ass very soon." And McDade produces an unsigned Get Well card from his pocket and puts it carefully through the railing's bars, where it lies next to Gately's arm and begins to open up from being folded and shoved in a pocket. It's clear the thing was shoplifted. It's probably the pathetic unsigned folded hot card, but Gately, suddenly stricken by the heat of the waves of self-pity and resentment he feels about not only the card, but about the prospect of these booger-chewing clowns not standing up to eyewitness for his, say, offendendo, after he just tried to do his sober job on one of their behalf, and is now lying here in a level of increasing dextral discomfort these limp punks couldn't imagine if they tried, getting ready to have to say no to grinning Pakistanis about his disease's drug of choice, with an invasive tube down his mouth, and no notebook after he asked for one, and needing to shit, and to know the day, and no big black nurse in view, and unable to move. It suddenly seems awful starry-eyed to be willing to look on the course of events as evidence of the protection and care of a higher power. It's a bit hard to see why a, quote, loving God would have him go through the sausage grinder of getting straight just to lie here in total discomfort and have to say no to medically advised substances and get ready to go to jail just because Pat M. doesn't have the brass to make these selfish, bottom-feeding dipshits stand up and do the right thing for once. The resentment and fear make cords stand out on Gately's purple neck, and he looks ferocious, but not at all jolly. Because what if God is really the cruel and vengeful figurant Boston AA swears up and down he isn't, and he gets you straight, just so you can feel all the more keenly every bevel and edge of the special punishments he's got lined up for you? Because why the fuck say no to a whole rubber bulb full of Demerol's somnolent hum if these are the, quote, rewards of sobriety and rabidly active work in AA? The resentment, fear, and self-pity are almost narcotizing, way beyond anything he'd felt when hapless Canadians punched or shot him. This was a sudden, total, bitter, impotent Job-type rage that always sends any sobered addict falling back and up inside himself, like vapor up a chimney. Dial and McDade were backing away from him, as well they fucking might. Gately's big head felt hot and cold, and his pulse line on the overhead monitor started to look like the Rockies. The residence between Gately and the door, wide-eyed, now suddenly parted to let someone pass. At first, all Gately could see between them was the kidney-shaped plastic bedpan and a cylindrical, syringe-snouted, ketchup bottle-ish thing with Fleet down the side in cheery green. It took this equipment a second to signify. Then he saw the nurse that came forward bearing the stuff, and his raging heart fell out of him with a thud. Dial and McDade made hearty farewell noises and melted out the door with the vague alacrity of seasoned drug addicts. The nurse was no slot-mouthed penguin or booming mammy. This nurse looked like something out of a racy nurseware catalog, like somebody that had to detour blocks out of her way to avoid construction sites at lunchtime. Gately's projected image of his and this gorgeous nurse's union unfolded and became instantly grotesque. Him, prone and ass up on the porch swing, she, white-haired and angelic, and bearing something away in a kidney-shaped pan to the towering pile behind the retirement cottage. Everything angry in him evaporated as he got ready to just fucking die of mortification. The nurse stood there and twirled the bedpan on one finger and flexed the long Fleet cylinder a couple times. and made an arc of clear fluid come out the tip and hang in the window light, like a gunslinger twirling his six-shooter around to casually show off, smiling in a way that simply snapped Gately's spine. He began to mentally recite the Serenity Prayer. When he moved, he could smell his own sour smell, not to mention the time and pain involved in rolling onto his left side and exposing his ass, and pulling his knees to his chest with one arm.
"Hug those knees like they were your sweetie, is what we say," she said,
putting a terribly soft, cool hand on Gately's ass, without jostling the catheter or IVs, or the thick taped tube that went down his mouth to God knows where. I was going to go back up to see about Stice's defenestration, to check on Mario, and change my socks and examine my expression in the mirror for unintentional hilarity, to listen to Oren's phone messages, and then the protracted death aria from Tosca once or twice. There is no music for free-floating misery, like Tosca. I was moving down the damp hall when it hit. I don't know where it came from. It was some variant of the telescopically self-conscious panic that can be so devastating during a match. I'd never felt quite this way off court before. It wasn't wholly unpleasant. Unexplained panic sharpens the senses almost past enduring. Lyle had taught us this. You perceive things very intensely. Lyle's counsel had been to turn the perception and attention on the fear itself, but he'd shown us how to do this only on court, in play. Everything came at too many frames per second. Everything had too many aspects. But it wasn't disorienting. The intensity wasn't unmanageable. It was just intense and vivid. It wasn't like being high, but it was still very lucid. The world seemed suddenly almost edible, there for the ingesting. The thick skin of light over the baseboard's varnish, the cream of the ceiling's acoustic tile, the deerskin brown longitudinal grain in the room's door's darker wood, the dull brass gleam of the knobs. It was without the abstract, cognitive quality of Bob or Star. The turn signal red of the stairwell's lit exit sign. Sleepy T.P. Peterson came out of the bathroom in a dazzling plaid robe, his face and feet salmon-colored from the shower's heat, and vanished across the hall into his room, without seeing me, wobbling, leaning against the cool mint wall of the hallway. But the panic was there, too, endocrinal, paralyzing, and with an over-cognitive, bad-trip-like element that I didn't recognize from the very visceral on-court attacks of fear. Something like a shadow flanked the vividness and lucidity of the world. The concentration of attention did something to it. What didn't seem fresh and unfamiliar seemed suddenly old as stone. It all happened in the space of a few seconds. The familiarity of academy routine took on a crushing cumulative aspect. The total number of times I'd schlepped up through the rough cement steps of the stairwell, seen my faint red reflection in the paint of the fire door, walked the 56 steps down the hall to our room, opened the door and eased it gently back, flush in the jam to keep from waking Mario. I re-experienced the year's total number of steps, movements, the breaths and pulses involved, then the number of times I would have to repeat the same processes day after day in all kinds of light, until I graduated and moved away, and then began the same exhausting process of exit and return in some dormitory at some tennis power university somewhere. Maybe the worst part of the cognitions involved the incredible volume of food I was going to have to consume over the rest of my life. Meal after meal, plus snacks, day after day after day, experiencing this food in toto. Just the thought of the meat alone. 1 megagram, 2 megagrams. I experienced vividly the image of a broad, cool, well-lit room piled floor-to-ceiling with nothing but the lightly breaded chicken fillets I was going to consume over the next 60 years. The number of fowl vivisected for a lifetime's meat. The amount of hydrochloric acid and bilirubin and glucose and glycogen and glucanol produced and absorbed and produced in my body. And another dimmer room filled with the rising mass of the excrement I'd produce, the room's double-locked steel door gradually bowing outward with the mounting pressure. I had to put my hand out against the wall and stand there, hunched, until the worst of it passed. I watched the floor dry. Its dull shine brightened behind me in the snow light from the east window. The wall's baby blue was complexly filigreed with bumps and clots of paint. An unmopped glob of Kenkel spit sat by the corner of VR5's door's jamb, quivering slightly as the door rattled in its frame. There were scuffles and thumps from upstairs. It was still snowing like hell. I lay on my back on the carpet of viewing room 5, still on the second floor, fighting the sense that I'd either never been here before, or I'd spent lifetimes just here. The entire room was paneled in a cool, yellow, shimmering material called Kevlon. The viewer took up half the south wall and was dead and gray-green. The carpet's green was close to this color, too. The instructional and motivational cartridges were in a large glass bookcase, whose central shelves were long, and whose top and bottom shelving tapered down to almost nothing. Ovoid would convey the case's shape. I had the NASA glass with my toothbrush in it balanced on my chest. It rose whenever I inhaled. I'd had the NASA glass since I was a little boy, and its decal of white helmeted figures, waving authoritatively through the windows of a prototype shuttle, was faded and incomplete. After a time, sleepy T.P. Peterson put his wet-combed head in the door and said Lamont Chu wanted to know whether what was happening outside qualified as a blizzard. It took over a minute of my not saying anything for him to go away. The ceiling panels were grotesquely detailed. They seemed to come after you, like some invasive ETA patron backing you up against the wall at a party. The ankle throbbed dully in the snowstorm's low pressure. I relaxed my throat and simply let the excess saliva run post-nasally back and down. The Moms' mother had been ethnic Quebecois, her father Anglo-Canadian. The term used in the Yale Journal of Alcohol Studies for this man was binge drinker. All my grandparents were deceased. Himself's middle name had been Orin, his father's own father's name. The VR's entertainment cartridges were arrayed on wall-length shelves of translucent polyethylene. Their individual cases were all either clear plastic or glossy black plastic. My full name is Harold James Incandenza, and I am 183.6 centimeters tall in stocking feet. Himself designed the Academy's indirect lighting, which is ingenious and close to full spectrum. VR5 contained a large couch, 4 reclining chairs, a mid-sized recumbency, 6 green corduroy spectation pillows stacked in a corner, 3 end tables, and a coffee table of Mylar with inlaid coasters. The overhead lighting in every ETA room came from a small carbon graphite spotlight directed upward at a complexly alloyed reflecting plate above it. No rheostat was required. A small joystick controlled the brightness by altering the little spot's angle of incidence to the plate. Himself's films were arranged on the 3rd shelf of the entertainment case. The Moms' full name is Avril Mondragon Tavis Incandenza, EDD, PhD. She is 197 centimeters tall in flats, and still came up only to Himself's ear when he straightened and stood erect. For almost a month in the weight room, Lyle had been saying that the most advanced level of vipassana, or insight meditation, consisted in sitting in fully awakened contemplation of one's own death. I had held big buddy sessions in VR5 throughout the month of September. The Moms had grown up without a middle name. The etymology of the term blizzard is essentially unknown. The full-spectrum lighting system had been a labor of love from Himself to the Moms, who'd agreed to leave Brandeis and head up the Academy's academics, and had ethnic Canadians' horror of fluorescent light. But by the time the system had been installed and debugged, the gestalt of the Moms' lumophobia had extended to all overhead lighting, and she never used her office's spot-and-plate system. Petropolis Khan put his large shaggy head in and asked, "What was all this brouhaha upstairs?" The thumps and cryings out. He asked whether I was going to breakfast. The scuttlebutt on breakfast was sausage analog and OJ with palpable pulp, he said. I closed my eyes and recalled that I'd known Petropolis Khan for 3 years and 3 months. Khan went away. I could feel his head's withdrawal from the doorway, a very slight suction in the room's air. I needed to fart, but had not so far farted. The atomic weight of carbon is 12.01 and change. A small and carefully monitored game of Eschaton slated for the mid-AM, with, according to rumor, Pemulus himself as game master, was certain to be snowed out. It had begun to occur to me, driving back from Natick on Tuesday, that if it came down to a choice between continuing to play competitive tennis and continuing to be able to get high, it would be a nearly impossible choice to make. The distant way in which this fact appalled me, itself, appalled me. The founder of the Sub-14s Tunnel Club had been Heath Pearson, as a very little boy. The rumor that Pemulus himself would don the beanie for the next Eschaton came from Kent Blott. Pemulus had been avoiding me ever since I returned from Natick on Tuesday, as if he sensed something. The woman behind the register at the Shell station last night had recoiled as I approached to present my card before pumping, as if she too had seen something in my expression I hadn't known was there. The North American Collegiate Dictionary claimed that any very heavy snowstorm with high winds qualified as a blizzard. Himself, for 2 years before his death, had had this delusion of silence when I spoke. I believed I was speaking, and he believed I was not speaking. Mario averred that himself had never accused him of not speaking. I tried to recall whether I had ever brought the subject up with the Moms. The Moms was at pains to be completely approachable on all subjects, except himself, and what had been going on between her and himself, as himself withdrew more and more. She never forbade questions about it. She just got so pained and blurry-faced that you felt cruel asking her anything. I considered whether Pemulus' cessation of the math tutorials was perhaps an oblique affirmation, a kind of, you are ready. Pemulus often communicated in a kind of esoteric code. It was true that I had kept mostly to myself in the room since Tuesday. The condensed OED, in a rare bit of florid imprecision, defined blizzard as a furious blast of frost, wind, and blinding snow, in which man and beast frequently perish, claiming the word was either a neologism or a corruption of the French blesse, coined in English by a reporter for Iowa's Northern Vindicator in B.S. 1864. Oren alleged in YTMP that when he took the Moms' car in the morning, he sometimes observed the smeared prints of nude human feet on the inside of the windshield. VR5's heating duct's grill gave off a sterile hiss. All up and down the hall were sounds of the academy coming to life, making competitive ablutions, venting anxiety and complaints at the possible blizzard outside, wanting to play. There was heavy foot traffic in the third-floor hall above me. Oren was going through a period where he was attracted only to young mothers of small children. A hunched way. She hunches. You hunch. John Wayne had had a violent allergic reaction to a decongestant, and had commandeered the WETA microphone and publicly embarrassed himself on Trolch's Tuesday broadcast, apparently, and had been taken to St. Elizabeth's overnight for observation, but had recovered quickly enough to come home and then finish ahead, even of Stice in Wednesday's conditioning run. I missed the entire thing, and was filled in by Mario on my return from Natick. Wayne had apparently said unkind things about various ETA staff and administration, none of which anyone who knew Wayne and all he stood for had taken seriously. Relief that he was okay had dominated everyone's accounts of the whole incident. The Moms herself had apparently stayed by Wayne's side late into the night at St. E's, which Boo Boo felt was estimable and just like the Moms. Simply imagining the total number of times my chest will rise and fall. And rise. If you want prescriptive specificity, you go to a hard-ass. Sidney and Schneewen's Dictionary of Environmental Sciences require 12 centimeters an hour of continuous snowfall, minimum winds of 60 kilometers per hour, and visibility of less than 500 meters. And only if these conditions obtained for more than 3 hours was it a blizzard. Less than 3 hours was a C4 squall. The dedication and sustained energy that go into true perspicacity and expertise were exhausting, even to think about. It now lately sometimes seemed like a kind of black miracle to me that people could actually care deeply about a subject or pursuit. I could go on caring this way for years on end, could dedicate their entire lives to it. It seemed admirable and, at the same time, pathetic. We are all dying to give our lives away. To something, maybe. God or Satan, politics or grammar, topology or philately. The object seemed incidental to this will to give oneself away, utterly. To games or needles, to some other person. Something pathetic about it. A flight from, in the form of a plunging into. Flight from exactly what? These rooms blandly filled with excrement and meat? To what purpose? This was why they started us here so young, to give ourselves away before the age when the questions why and to what grow real beaks and claws. It was kind, in a way. Modern German is better equipped for combining gerunds and prepositions than is its mongrel cousin. The original sense of addiction involved being bound over, dedicated, either legally or spiritually. To devote one's life, plunge in. I had researched this. Steiss had asked whether I believed in ghosts. It's always seemed a little preposterous that Hamlet, for all his paralyzing doubt about everything, never once doubts the reality of the ghost. Never questions whether his own madness might not in fact be unfeigned. Steiss had promised something boggling to look at. That is, whether Hamlet might be only feigning. I kept thinking of the film and cartridge studies professor's final soliloquy in himself's unfinished, good-looking men in small, clever rooms that utilize every centimeter of available space with mind-boggling efficiency, the sour parody of academia that the moms had taken as an odd personal slap. I kept thinking, I really should go up and check on the darkness. There seemed to be so many implications, even to thinking about sitting up and standing up and exiting VR5 and taking a certain variable according to stride length number of steps to the stairwell door, on and on. Just the thought of getting up made me glad I was lying on the floor. I was on the floor. I felt the Nile green carpet with the back of each hand. I was completely horizontal. I was comfortable lying perfectly still and staring at the ceiling. I was enjoying being one horizontal object in a room filled with horizontality. Charles Tavis is probably not related to the moms by actual blood. Her extremely tall French-Canadian mother died when the moms was 8. Her father left their potato farm on business a few months later and was gone for several weeks. He did this sort of thing with some frequency. A binge drinker. Eventually there would be a telephone call from some distant province or U.S. state, and one of the hired men would go off to bail him out. From this disappearance, though, he returned with a new bride the moms had known nothing about, an American widow named Elizabeth Tavis, who, in the stilted Vermont wedding photo, seems almost certainly to have been a dwarf. The huge, square head, the relative length of the trunk compared to the legs, the sunken nasal bridge and protruding eyes, the stunted phocomelic arms around Squire Mondragon's right thigh, one khaki-colored cheek pressed affectionately against his belt buckle. C.T. was the infant son she'd brought to the new union, his father, a ne'er-do-well, killed in a freak accident playing competitive darts in a Brattleboro tavern, just as they were trying to adjust the obstetric stirrups for the achondroplastic Mrs. Tavis's labor and delivery. Her smile in the wedding photo is homodontic. According to Orin, though, C.T. and the moms claim Mrs. T. was not a true homodont the way, for instance, Mario is a true homodont. Every single one of Mario's teeth is a second bicuspid. So it was all rather up in the air. The account of the disappearance, Dart's accident and dental incongruity comes from Orin, who claimed to have decocted it all out of an extended one-sided conversation he had with a distraught C.T. in the waiting room of Brigham and Women's OBGYN while the mom's was prematurely delivering Mario. Orin had been 7 years old. Himself had been in the delivery room, where apparently Mario's birth was quite a touch-and-go thing. The fact that Orin was our one and only source for data shrouded the whole thing in further ambiguity as far as I was concerned. Pinpoint accuracy had never been Orin's forte. The wedding photo was available for inspection, of course. and confirmed Mrs. Tavis as huge-headed and wildly short. Neither Mario nor I had ever approached the moms on the issue, possibly out of fear of reopening psychic wounds from a childhood that had always sounded unhappy. All I knew for sure was that I had never approached her about it. For their part, the moms and CT have never represented themselves as anything other than unrelated, but extremely close. The attack of panic and prophylactic focus's last spasm now, suddenly, almost overwhelmed me with the intense horizontality that was all around me in the viewing room. The ceiling, floor, carpet, tabletops, the chair seats, and the shelves at their backs tops, and much more. The shimmering horizontal lines in the Kevlon wall fabric, the very long top of the viewer, the top and bottom borders of the door, the spectation pillows, the viewer's bottom, the squat black cartridge drives top and bottom, and the little push-down controls that protruded like stunted tongues, the seemingly endless horizontality of the couches and chairs and recumbency seats, the wall of shelves, every line, the varied horizontal shelving of the ovoid case, two of every cartridge case's four sides, on and on. I lay in my tight little sarcophagus of space. The horizontality piled up all around me. I was the meat in the room's sandwich. I felt awakened to a basic dimension I'd neglected during years of upright movement, of standing and running and stopping and jumping, of walking endlessly upright from one side of the court to the other. I had understood myself for years as basically vertical, an odd forked stalk of stuff and blood. I felt denser now. I felt more solidly composed now that I was horizontal. I was impossible to knock down. Gately's cognomen growing up and moving through public grades had been Bim, or Bimmy, or the Bimulator, etc., for the acronym BIM, Big Indestructible Moron. This was on Boston's North Shore, mostly Beverly and Salem. His head had been huge, even as a kid. By the time he hit puberty, at 12, the head seemed a yard wide. A regulation football helmet was like a beanie on him. His coaches had to order special helmets. Gailey was worth the cost. Every coach past sixth grade told him he was a lock for a Division I college team if he bore down and kept his eye on the prize. Memories of half a dozen different necklace, buzz cut, and pre-infarcted coaches all condense around a raspy emphasis on bearing down, and predictions of a limitless future for Don G., Bimmy G., right up until he dropped out in high school's junior year. Gailey went both ways, fullback on offense, outside linebacker on D. He was big enough for the line, but his speed would have been wasted there. Already carrying 230 pounds and bench-pressing well over that, Gailey clocked a 4.440 in seventh grade, and the legend is that the Beverly Middle School coach ran even faster than that into the locker room to jack off over the stopwatch. And his biggest asset was his outsized head, Gately's. The head was indestructible. When they needed yards, they'd shift to isolate Gately on one defender and get in the ball, and he'd lower his head and charge, eyes on the turf. The top of his special helmet was like a train's cowcatcher coming at you. Defenders, pads, helmets, and cleats bounced off the head, often in different directions, and the head was fearless. It was like it had no nerve endings or pain receptors or whatever. Gailey amused teammates by letting them open and close elevator doors on the head. He let people break things over his head, lunchboxes, cafeteria trays, the spectacled weenies, violin cases, lacrosse sticks. By age 13, he never had to buy beers. He'd bet some kid of six he could take a shot with this or that object to the head. His left ear is permanently kind of gnarled from elevator door impacts, and Gately favors a kind of long-sighted, Prince, valiantish bowl cut to help cover the misshapen ear. One cheekbone still has a dented violet cast from 10th grade. When a North Reading kid at a party bet him a 12-pack on a shot with a sock full of nickels and then clocked him under the eye with it instead of the skull, It took Beverly's whole offensive line to pull Gately off what was left of the kid. The juvenile line on Gately was that he was totally jolly and laid back and easygoing up to a certain point, but that if you crossed that point with him, you better be able to beat a 4.440. He was always kind of a boy's boy. He had a jolly ferocity about him that scared girls, and he had no idea how to deal with girls except to try and impress them by letting them watch somebody do something to his head. He was never what you'd call a ladies' man. At parties, he was always at the center of the crowd that drank instead of dancing. It was surprising, maybe, given Gately's size and domestic situation, that he wasn't a bully. He wasn't kindly or heroic or a defender of the weak. It's not like he stepped kindly in to protect weenies and misfits from the predations of those kids that were bullies. He just had no interest in brutalizing the weak. It's still not clear to him if this was to his credit or not. Things might have been different if the MP had ever knocked Gately around instead of focusing all his attention on the progressively weaker Mrs. G. He smoked his first Dubois at age 9. A hard little needle-thin joint bought off junior high niggers and smoked with 3 other grade school football players in a vacant summer cottage one had the key to, watching broadcast, televised niggers run amok in a flaming Los Angeles, California, after some finest got home-movied crewing on a nigger in the worst way. Then, his first real drunk a few months later, after he and the players hooked up with an Orkin man that liked to get kids all blunt on screwdrivers and that wore brown shirts and jackboots in his off hours, and lectured them about Zog and the Turner Diaries while they drank the O.J. and vodka he'd bought them, and look at him blandly and roll their eyes at each other. Soon, none of the football players Gately hung with were interested in much of anything except trying to get high and holding air guitar and pissing contests and talking, theoretically, about exing big-haired North Shore girls and trying to think up things to break over Gately's head. They all had, like, domestic situations, too. Gately was the only one of them truly dedicated to football, and that was probably just because he'd been told, over and over, that he had real talent and limitless futures. He was classified attention deficit and special ed from grade school on, with particular deficits in language arts. But that was at least partly because Mrs. G. could barely read, and Gately wasn't interested in making her feel worse. But there was no deficit in his attention to ball, or to cold foamers or screwdrivers or high-resin Dubois, or especially to applied pharmacology. Not once he'd done his first quaalude at age 13.
362.
Just as Gately's whole recall of his screwdriver and sensimilia beginnings tends to telescope into one memory of pissing orange juice into the Atlantic, he and the blunt, cruel Beverly players and bullies he partied with drinking whole quarts of throat-warming O.J. at a shot and standing ankle-deep in grit on the North Shore shore, facing east and sending long arcs of legal pad yellow piss into onrushing breakers that came in and creamed around their feet. The foam, warm and yellow shot with their piss, like spitting into the wind. Gately, at the podium, had started saying, it turns out he was pissing on himself right from the start with alcohol. In just the same way, the whole couple years before he discovered oral narcotics, the whole period 13 to 15 when he was a devotee of Quaaludes and Heffenreffer brand beer collapses and gathers itself under what he still recalls as the attack of the killer sidewalks. Quaaludes and Heffenreffer also marked Gately's entree into a whole new, rather more sinister and less athletic social set at BMS, one member of which was Trent Kite.
363.
A dyed-in-wool laptop-carrying weenie, chinless and with a nose like a taper, and pretty much the last fanatical Grateful Dead fan under age 40 on the U.S. East Coast, whose place of honor in the sinister Beverly Middle School drug set was due entirely to his gift for transforming the kitchen of any vacationing parent's house into a rudimentary pharmaceutical laboratory, using, like, barbecue sauce bottles as Erlenmeyer flasks and microwave ovens to cycleize OH and carbon into 3-ring compounds, Synthesizing methylene dioxy psychedelics.
364.
From nutmeg and sassafras oil. Ether from charcoal starter. Designer meth from tryptophan and L-histidine. Sometimes using only a gas top range in parental farberware, able even to decoct usable concentrations of tetrahydrofuran from PVC pipe cleaner. Which, at that time, best of British luck ordering tetrahydrofuran from any chemical company in the 48 contigs, 6 provinces without getting paid an immediate visit by DEA guys in three-piece suits and reflecting shades. And then using the tetrahydrofuran and ethanol and any protein-binding catalyst to turn plain old Somonex into something just one H3C molecule away from good old biphasic methaqualone, a.k.a. the intrepid quaalude. Kite had called his quaalude isotopes Quo Vadis, and they were a great favorite for 13 to 15-year-old Bimmy G. And the slouched, sharp-haired, sinister set he dropped lewds and Quo Vadises with, washing them down with Heffenreffers, resulting in a kind of mnemonic brownout where the entire 2-year interval, the same interval during which the ex-MP found somebody else, a Newburyport divorcee who apparently put up a more sporting fight than Mrs. G, and decamped in his sticker-covered Ford with his Siemens bag and peacoat, the whole period's become, in Gately's sober memory, just the vague era of the attack of the killer sidewalks. Quaaludes and 16-ounce Heffenreffers awakened Gately and his new droogs to the usually dormant but apparently ever-lurking ill will of innocent-seeming public sidewalks everywhere. You didn't have to be brainy Trent Kite to figure out the equation. Quaaludes plus, not even that many beers, equals getting whapped by the nearest sidewalk. As in, you're walking innocently along, down a sidewalk, and out of nowhere, the sidewalk comes rushing up to meet you. Whap! Happened time after fucking time. It made the whole crew resent having to walk anywhere on Quo Vadises because of not having driver's licenses yet, which gives you some idea of the sum total IQ brought to bear on the problem of the attacks. A tiny permanent cast in his left eye, and what looks like a chin dimple, are Gately's legacy from the period before moving up to Percocets. Which one advantage of the move deeper into oral narcs was that Percocets plus Heffenreffers didn't allow you even enough upright mobility to make you vulnerable to sidewalks' ever-lurking ill will. It was amazing that none of this stuff seemed much to hurt Gately's performance playing ball, but then he was as devoted to football as he was to oral CNS depressants. At least for a while. He had disciplined personal rules back then. He absorbed substances only at night, after practice. Not so much as a fractional foamer between 0900 hours and 1800 hours during the seasons of practice and play, and he settled for just a single Dubois on Thursday evenings before actual games. During football season, he ruled himself with an iron hand until the sunset, then threw himself on the mercy of sidewalks and the somnolent hum. He used class to catch up on REM sleep. By freshman year, he was starting on the Beverly-Salem High School Minutemen varsity and was on academic probation. Most of the sinister set he'd hung with were expelled for truancy, or trafficking, or worse by sophomore year. Gately kept hanging in, and on, till 17. But Quaaludes and Quo Vadis and Percocets are lethal in terms of homework, especially washed down with Heffenreffer. And extra especially if you're academically ambivalent and ADD classified, and already using every particle of your self-discipline protecting football from the substances. And, unhappily, high school is totally unlike higher education, in terms of major sport coaches' influence over instructors, athletes and grades-wise. Kite got Gately through math and special ed science, and the French teacher was getting her strabismic eyeballs fucked out by the Minutemen's tanned lounge lizard of an offensive coordinator on the behalf of Gately, and a semi-retarded tight end. But English just fucking killed him, Gately. All 4 of the English teachers the athletic department tried Gately on had this Sieg Heil idea that it was somehow cruel to pass a kid that couldn't do the work. And the athletic department pointing out to them that Gately had an especially challenging domestic situation, and that flunking Gately and rendering him ineligible for ball would eliminate his one reason even to stay on in school, these were to no, like, avail. English was his sink-or-swim situation, what he then termed his water-loo. Term papers, he could more or less swing. The football coach had weenies on retainer. But the in-class themes and tests killed Gately, who simply didn't have enough will left over after sunset to choose like the crushingly dull Ethan Frum over Quo Vadis and Heffenreffer. Plus, by this time, three different schools' authorities had him convinced he was basically dumb anyway. But mostly it was the substances. This one particular BSHS athletic department hired weenie of an English tutor, spent a sophomore year, March's worth of evenings, in Gately's company, and by Easter, the kid weighed 95 pounds and had a nose ring and hand tremors and was placed by his frantic functional parents in a juvenile intervention rehab, where the weenie's whole first week of withdrawal was spent in a corner reciting Howl in high-volume Chaucerian English. Gately flunked sophomore comp in May and lost the fall's eligibility and withdrew from school for a year to preserve his junior season. But then, without the only other thing he'd been devoted to, the psychic emergency brake was off, and Gately's 16th year is still mostly a gray blank, except for his mother's new red chintz TV-watching couch, and also the acquaintance of an accommodating Rite Aid pharmacist's assistant with disfiguring eczema and serious gambling debts. Plus, memories of terrible rear ocular itching, and of a basic diet of convenience store crud, plus the vegetables from his mother's vodka glass while she slept. When he finally returned for his sophomore year of class and junior year of ball at 17 and 284 pounds, Gately was enervated, flabby, apparently narcoleptic, and on a need schedule so inflexible that he needed 15 milligrams of good old oxycodone hydrochloride out of his pocket's Tylenol bottle every 3 hours to keep the shakes off. He was like a huge, confused kitten out on the field. The coach made him go in for PET scans, fearing MS or Lou Gehrig's, and even the classic comics version of Ethan Frum was now beyond his abilities. And good old Kite was gone by that last September of unsubsidized time, admitted early on a full ride in comp science by Salem State U, meaning Gately was now on his own in remedial math and chemistry. On offense, Gately lost his starting spot in the third game to a big, clear-eyed freshman the coach said showed nearly limitless potential. Then Mrs. Gately suffered her cirrhotic hemorrhage and cerebral blood thing in late October, just before the midterms Gately was getting ready to fail. Bored-eyed guys in white cotton, blue bubbles, and loaded her in the back of a leisurely, sirenless ambulance, and took her first to the hospital, and then to a Medicaid LTI out across the year-old beach span in Point Shirley.
365.
The backs of Gately's eyes were too itchy for him to even be able to stand out on the red pocked stoop's steps and see to wave adios. The first Gasper he ever smoked was that day, a 100 out of a half-finished pack of his mother's generics that she left. He didn't even ever go back to BSHS to clean out his lockers. He never played organized ball again. I may have been dozing. Some more heads came and awaited response and left. I may have dozed. It occurred to me that I didn't have to eat if I was not hungry. This presented itself as almost a revelation. I hadn't been hungry in over a week. I could remember when I was always hungry, constantly hungry. Then at some point Pemulus's head appeared in the doorway, his strange twin-towered A.M. cowlick bobbing as he looked back over each shoulder out into the hallway. His right eye was either twitchy or swollen from sleep. Something was wrong with it. "Yellow," he said. I pretended to shade my eyes. "Howdy there, stranger." It is not Pemulus's way to apologize, or explain, or worry that you might think ill of him. In this, He reminded me of Mario. This almost regal lack of insecurity is hard to put together with his crippling neurasthenia on court.
"Sup?"
he said, not moving from the doorway. I could see my asking him where he'd been all week, leading to so many different possible responses and further questions that the prospect was almost overwhelming. So enervating, I could barely get out that I'd just been lying here on the floor. "Lying here is all," I told him.
"So I just got told," he said. "The patropulator mentioned hysterics."
It was almost impossible to shrug, lying supine on thick shag.
"See for yourself," I said.
Pemulus came all the way in. It became the only thing in the room that understood itself as basically vertical. He didn't look very good. His color wasn't good. He had not shaved, and a dozen little black bristles jutted from the ball of his chin. He gave the impression of chewing gum, even though he was not chewing gum. He said,
"Thinking?"
"The opposite. Thought prophylaxis."
"Feeling a little punk?"
"Can't complain." I rolled my eyes up at him. He made a sharp, glottal stop. He moved toward the periphery of my vision and fit himself into the seam of two walls behind me. I heard him sliding down to assume the back-supported squat he sometimes liked. The patropulator was Patropulus Khan. I was thinking of the final film lecture in Good-Looking Men in Small Clever Rooms, and then a CT's misadventure at himself's funeral. The mom's had had himself interred in her family's traditional plot in Lillet province. I heard a whoop and two crashes directly overhead. My ribcage contracted and expanded.
"Inkster?"
Pamela said after a time. A noteworthy thing turned out to be that the mound of earth on a freshly filled grave seems airy and risen and plump, like dough.
"Al?"
Pemulus said.
"Jawohl."
"We've got some really important interfacing to do, brother." I didn't say anything. There were too many potential responses, both witty ones and earnest ones. I could hear Pemulus's cowlicks brushing each wall as he looked to either side, and the slight sound of a small zipper being played with.
"I'm thinking we could go someplace discreet and really interface."
"I'm a highly tuned horizontal antenna, tuned into you, lying right here."
"I was meaning, could we go somewheres?"
So this urgency all of a sudden. I was trying to make my intonation Jewish, motherish, but melodic dip-rise-dip. "All week, not a call, not a card. Now I should hear this about urgency." "Seen your mom's around lately?" "Haven't seen her all week. Doubtless she's over helping CT arrange a weather venue." I paused. "I haven't seen him all week either, come to think," I said.
"The eschaton's a no-go," Pemulus said. "The map's a mess out there."
"We're going to get an announcement about the Quebec kids very soon, I can feel it," I said. "I'm that highly tuned in this position."
"Let's say let's skip the sausage analog and whip down to steak and sundae and eat."
There was an extended pause as I ran a response tree. Pemulus was zipping and unzipping something with a short zipper. I couldn't decide. I finally had to choose almost at random. "I'm trying to cut down on patronizing places with N in their name."
"Listen."
I heard his knees creak as he leaned in toward the top of my head.
"About the tu savi quoi.
The ide ime ise, the synthetic bacchanal. That's definitely off, Mike. Talk about the map being a mess.
That's part of what we need to interface about, if you get off your, literally, your ass here."
I spent a minute watching the NASA glass fall and rise. "Don't even start, M.M.
"What start?"
"We're on hiatus, remember? We're living like Shiite Muslims for the 30 days you miraculously blarneyed the guy into giving us.
Blarney wasn't why we got it, Inc., is a thing.
And now, what, 20 days to go? We're going to produce urine like a mullah's babe. We agreed."
"This isn't..."
Pemulus started. I farted, but it didn't produce a noise. I was bored. I couldn't remember a time when Pemulus had bored me. "And I do not need you launching temptation rhetoric my way," I said. Keith Freer appeared in the doorway, leaning against the jamb with his bare arms crossed. He was still wearing the weird unitard he slept in, which made him look like someone who tore phone books in half at a sideshow.
"Does somebody have an explanation why there's human flesh on the hall window upstairs?" he said.
"We're conversing here," Famulus told him.
I half sat up.
"Flesh?"
Freer looked down at me.
"This is nothing to laugh at, I don't think, Hal. There's, I swear, to fucking God, a human strip of forehead flesh upstairs on the hall window. And what looks like two eyebrows and a bit of nose. And now Tall Paul says down in the lobby, Stice was seen coming out of the infirmary wearing something out of Zorro."
Famulus was completely vertical, standing again. I could hear his knees as he rose.
"It's like a tete-a-tete in here, brother. We're in here bunkered. Mono up.
Stice got stuck to the window," I explained, lying all the way back down. "Kinkel and Brant were going to detach him with warm water from a janitorial bucket."
Famulus said, "How do you get stuck to a window?"
"Well, from the looks, it looks like they detached half his face from his head,"
Freer said, feeling at his own forehead and shuddering a little. Kieran McKenna's little porcine snout appeared in a gap under Freer's arm. He still wore his stupid full-head gauze wrap for his supposed bruised skull.
"Did you guys get to see the darkness? Gottnick said he looks like a piece of cheese pizza, where somebody tore the cheese off. Gottnick said Trolch is charging $2 a look."
He ran off toward the stairwell without waiting for a reply, his pocket jingling madly. Freer looked at Famulus and opened his mouth, then apparently reconsidered and followed off down the hall. We could hear a couple of sarcastic whistles at Freer's unitard. Famulus reappeared at the top of my vision. His right eye was definitely twitching.
"This is what I meant about going someplace discreet. When have I ever urgently asked you to dialogue before, Ink?"
"Certainly not within the last few days, Mike, that's for sure." There was an extended pause. I raised my hands over my face and looked at their shapes against the indirect lights. Famulus finally said,
"Well, I'm going to go make sure I eat before I have to see Stice without a fucking forehead."
"Have an analog for me," I said. "Let me know if there's word on the meat. I'll eat if I'm going to have to play." Famulus licked his palm and tried to get his cowlicks to behave. From my vantage, he was high overhead and upside down.
"So you're going to get up and go up and get dressed and stand on one foot with that opera thing on at some point? Because I could eat and then come up. We could tell Mario we need a mano a tete."
Now I was making a cage of my hands and watching the light through its shape as I rotated it. "Will you do me a favor? Get good-looking men in small, clever rooms that utilize every centimeter of available space with mind-boggling efficiency out for me. It's about a dozen cartridges in from the right, on the third shelf down in the entertainment case. Cue it up to about 2300, 2350 maybe. The last 5 minutes or so." "The third shelf down," I said as he scanned, tapping a foot. "I've got all himself's stuff together on the third shelf." He scanned. "Baby pictures of famous dictators? Fun with teeth? Annular fusion is our fiend? I haven't even heard of half your dad's shit that's here. It's friend, not fiend. Either it's mislabeled or the label's peeling. And they're supposed to be alphabetized. It ought to be right next to flux in a box."
"And me using the poor guy's lab," Famulus said.
He loaded the player and turned on the viewer, his knees popping again as he squatted to set the cue to 2350. The huge screen hummed in a low pitch that ascended as it began to warm up, the screen taking on a milky blue aspect like the eye of a dead bird. Famulus's feet were bare, and I looked at the calluses on his heels. He tossed the cartridge's case carelessly on the couch or chair behind me and looked down.
"What the fuck's fun with teeth supposed to be about?"
I tried to shrug against the friction of the carpet.
"Pretty much what it says it's about."
The funeral had been held on the 5th or 6th of April in St. Adalbert, a small town built around spud storage facilities, fewer than 5 clicks west of the Great Concavity. We'd all had to fly up by way of Newfoundland because of the volume of waste displacement launches that spring, and commercial airlines hadn't yet had data on high-altitude dioxin levels over the concavity. Cloud cover prevented our seeing much of the New Brunswick coast, which I'm told was a mercy. What happened at the funeral service itself was simply that a circling gull scored a direct, white hit on the shoulder of CT's blue blazer, and that when he opened his mouth in shock at the direct hit, a large, blue-bodied fly flew right into his mouth and was hard to extract. Several persons laughed. It was no huge or dramatic thing. The moms probably laughed hardest of anyone. The teepee's tracker chugged and clicked, and the viewer bloomed. Pemulus had been wearing parachute pants and a tam-o-shanter and lensless spectacles, but no shoes. The cartridge started close to what I'd wanted to review. The protagonist's climactic lecture. All Anthony Heaven. All 50 kilos of him. Gripping the lectern with both hands so you could see that he was missing his thumbs. The sad, dyed strands combed over his bald spot, visible because he had his head down, reading the lecture in the deadening, academic monotone that himself so loved. The monotone was the reason why himself used Paul Anthony Heaven, a non-professional, by trade a data entry drone for ocean spray, in anything that required a deadening, institutional presence. Paul Anthony Heaven had also played the threatening supervisor in Wave Bye-Bye to the Bureaucrat, the Massachusetts State Commissioner for Beach and Water Safety in Safe Boating is No Accident, and a Parkinsonian corporate auditor in Low-Temperature Civics.
Thus the flood's real consequence is revealed to be desiccation, generations of hydrophobia on a pandemic scale, the protagonist was reading aloud.